Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, and welcome back to the Forma podcast from the Circe Institute Podcast Network. A podcast about the intersection of classical thought and contemporary culture, and also the audio companion to Forma Journal. I'm Heidi White. In this episode, I spoke with Dr. Gregory Hillis, who is a professor of theology at Bellarmine University in Kentucky. Dr. Hillis is a historical theologian with particular expertise in the patristic period. His interests also include Christian spirituality and ecclesiology, sacramental theology. So some really important theological contemplations come from this brilliant man. And Dr. Hillis is also an expert and a scholar of the works of Thomas Merton. I was eager to talk to Dr. Hillis about Thomas Merton, who was one of the most interesting figures in the 20th century spiritual scene, if there is such a thing as a spiritual scene. Thomas Merton was a convert to Christianity who became a Trappist monk and a social advocate and activist. He lived in the Abbey of Gethsemane, which is a monastery not far from Bellarmine University in Kentucky. And in fact, Dr. Hillis studies Thomas Merton at the Thomas Merton Center, and I wanted to hear more about his research and his discoveries on Merton, whom I find to be one of the most enigmatic and compelling Christian scholars, mystics, and advocates of the 20th century. For those of you who are subscribers to Forma Journal, you will recognize some of this conversation between Dr. Hillis and me. You may have read some excerpts in written form in the spring edition of the journal. And for those who are not subscribers, log on to www.formajournal.com to get your copy. So without further ado, here is my conversation with the remarkable Dr. Gregory Hillis. Greg, thank you so much for being here. We had, you and I went back and forth quite a bit trying to find the right time. Both of us were traveling and dealing with stuff. So thanks for hanging in there and being on the Forma podcast.
Absolutely.
All right. So you are a Thomas Merton scholar. Mm-hmm. I'm so intrigued by that. I love Thomas Merton's writings. I'll probably mention a little bit later how I came to know him and love him. But I'm curious first about you. Tell us about your personal interest and love for Thomas Merton. How did that develop?
It developed when I was 23. I was doing an undergraduate degree. I just got married. Kim and I married fairly young, and I didn't have anything to read over Christmas holidays, and I decided to pick up something that was on my shelf already. It was a copy of The Seven Story Mountain. I didn't know anything about the book or anything like that, but I read it. And, I have different feelings about the book now, but at the time, it was an incredibly important text for me because it was about this guy who was about my age, not having any idea what he was going to do with his life and having sort of a crisis of vocation. And at the time, I really didn't know what I was going to do with my life, and I was having a crisis of vocation. And so, although I knew that I wasn't going to have the same resolution as he did, he became a monk, and I was married. I just felt this incredible relief when he finally gets a resolution to his crisis. And I remember after I read that, I just started reading everything I could of his. And I particularly started reading his journals. The school where I went, the University of Waterloo, had a Merton scholar there named Michael Higgins. And I talked to him a little bit, and I went to some of his lectures, and I just became really interested in him. And then that interest, it didn't die off. I just started studying other things, and I did my master's and my PhD in early Christianity. And then this job came up at Bellarmine University in 2008. And I remember being really excited about it because I knew that Bellarmine University had the Thomas Merton Center.
Uh-huh.
And that's the official repository of his literary estate. It's what he set up before he died. And so when I came down here for an interview, I made sure to spend some time in the Merton Center and all that stuff. And so really since I got here, I've been cultivating not just a personal interest, but a scholarly interest as well.
So tell us then how that came to be. How did this go from personal interest to a professional vocation?
Well, As I mentioned, I did study early Christianity, and I did my master's thesis on Augustine, and then I did my doctoral work on Cyril of Alexandria. And I spent the first few years while I was here at Bellarmine writing on Cyril of Alexandria, and actually just had something published about Cyril recently. But it's not that I lost interest in him. It's more that I just started gaining more interest in the kind of ways in which Merton was able to speak to our contemporary circumstances.
Uh-huh.
And particularly what he had to say about dialogue, what he had to say about nonviolence, and also about the contemplative life. All those things I was really interested in. And so I haven't given up on early Christianity, but, you know, essentially it prepared me fairly well to study Merton and to write on him.
Wow. You are living your best life, Greg. I love hearing this.
Well, I remember, you know, the interesting thing, I mean, this is public knowledge, so it's not like I'm sharing a secret or anything like that, but when I was 25, I think, you know, I was so infatuated with Merton that I ended up getting a tattoo of a drawing that he did on my shoulder. And you know, so it's a bit surreal for me now to, I mean, I'm sitting in my office now and everything that really Merton ever wrote is about 50 feet away from me in the archives.
That's amazing.
And I'm able to go down to the monastery, and I know a number of the monks who knew Merton. And there was a time when my very first trip down to the Abbey of Gethsemane, one of my colleagues took me down there, and I met Brother Patrick Hart, who was Merton's secretary in the last few years of Merton's life. And I remember just being like, wow, I can't believe I'm like meeting this guy who knew Merton. And he asked me sort of what I was interested in, and then suggested that he had a book that maybe I could review for Cistercian Studies Quarterly. And so the next week, I get this package in the mail, and it's from the Abbey of Gethsemane. And
wow.
I mean, I cut it out and I put it in my journal.
Right? I know. The things that scholarly people geek out about are just, like, that's it, right? You're like, I have arrived.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
That's amazing. Okay, so as an early patristic scholar, do you see connections between the writings of the early church fathers and the teachings of Merton?
Yes. So Merton was immersed in the patristic period. I mean, he was incredibly gifted as a linguist, and so he was able to read Greek and Latin, and so read early Christian writers voraciously. And so if you read his journals, for example, they're just filled with references to Gregory of Nyssa, to Gregory of Nazianzus, to Augustine, to Tertullian, to all these important figures. And so he was, he was interested in medieval thinkers as well, and really shaped by Thomas Aquinas. But there was something about the patristic period that that really was important to him. And so to understand Merton, you have to understand the kind of atmosphere out of which he wrote, which was one, you know, surrounded by these writers, you know, both literally in terms of those books that, you know, that he was surrounded by, but also he sort of shared their theological imagination.
Wow. So I'm really interested in that, particularly in light of what you mentioned earlier, Merton's social consciousness. Mm-hmm. And he is beloved for that. And maybe he's very well known in contemporary culture for for many things amongst thoughtful Christians, but that may be the thing that he's most known for. Mm-hmm. And first of all, let's start out with this. How are Merton's, how are his life and his teachings relevant today in this troubled cultural moment, what he has to say about the social consciousness? And then I kind of want to dig into that connection between the past as well. But let's start with that.
Sure. So his writings on social issues like war and race and whatnot, the thing that I always emphasize with my students is that that's not really, you know, he didn't start writing about that until the late 50s, you know, and then into the 1960s, but it wasn't a departure for him. So, you know, he spent all of his, or a lot of his time writing before that on prayer and contemplation. And the thing that he emphasizes is not something that is reserved only for those who've devoted their lives to this, but that is possible for all people to experience this kind of contemplation. And in fact, what he comes to the conclusion of is that real peace, the kind of peace for which he ends up advocating and the kind of justice that he sees needing to take place racially in this country, he sees as intricately interwoven with the kind of contemplative vision that he talks about. So part of our problem, he says, is that we don't understand who we really are, and we don't understand who other people really are. And in order to see what he calls the true self, we have to spend time in silence. We have to be open to understanding who we really are and be open to the transforming power of God. And once we can do that, then we can start interacting with people in a way that is in accord with the kind of dignity and beauty that they all have. And so his social vision is one that's really intertwined with his contemplative vision.
Right.
Now, so that's one way. But when he starts talking about social issues, you know, obviously, I think his writings on war and on nonviolence are important, not just because we're in a time that is no less violent than when he was writing. I mean, there are some senses in which maybe it's a bit dated. I mean, there are people in the United States calling for a first strike against Russia, and you know, to actually use nuclear weapons against our enemies. But we're still living in a, you know, military industrial complex, and we still, all those nuclear weapons are still around. And there certainly is an understanding that he provides about what the nature of violence is and why it is that we need to overcome it. And then the aspect of his writings, and I'm focusing a lot of attention on that right now in my work, is it is one important aspect that often gets neglected is his writings on racism. And it's fascinating. You know, here he is, this white monk in the woods of Kentucky. And in 1963, he starts, it's really after reading the a couple of books by the civil rights activist James Baldwin.
Yeah.
He just starts writing these incredibly trenchant and important essays about the problem of racism. And his most important one there is one called Letters to a White Liberal. And that one kind of put him on the map, especially with civil rights activists, like Representative John Lewis, for example, who is, you know, he was one of the leaders crossing the bridge at Selma during the civil rights movement. He's on record as saying that he had two books in his backpack while crossing the bridge. One was a book of political science and the other was a book by Merton. And so white Catholics and white folk don't generally know, you know, that of Merton's record on this. But black Catholics and black civil rights leaders know Merton pretty well. And that's kind of something that I'm focusing on these days.
Wow. That is exciting research. I look forward to connecting more with that. So my first introduction to Merton, I was 34 years old. And I remember I was, it's funny, similar to you, you described having nothing to read. So you picked up Merton's Seven Story yeah. Mountain. I was in England. My husband was working on a RAF base in the Yorkshire Moors. And so on the weekends, we would travel with our kids. We had little kids. And mm-hmm. So I had picked up Merton's Seven Story Mountain from a used bookstore in Whitby, England. And just, I was intrigued by the title. And so, and I had kind of vaguely heard about Thomas Merton. You know, everyone's heard of his name, but so I picked it up and I think it was like £3. And I took it with me and we went on a train to Durham to go see the cathedral. And I was in Durham Cathedral, and it was, I think Evensong was happening on the other side of the cathedral. And the, have you ever been there? Have you been to?
I've never been, but I've been to England, but I've never been to the Durham cathedral.
So Durham
I've
is
always wanted to.
It's beautiful, but it's medieval, so it's not Gothic. So it's very dark, and it has kind of this cave-like feel to it. And it somehow escaped Cromwell. Nobody knows how. Like, it was just not damaged at all. So it's completely intact. But it's not necessarily beautiful because it's not Gothic. It's just very dark. But it because of that, it has this solemnity to it. So, and it has, of like all cathedrals do, a graveyard very close. And so I remember standing in this cathedral and just being overwhelmed by thinking that I was in a place where the same worship had been kept for 1,100 years. And this was, and I was happened to be there. I was so overwhelmed by that. And then I went out and I leaned against a gravestone and I started reading Thomas Merton for the first time. and I didn't know what I was getting into. And that was a, I mean, a turning point in my spiritual life, those two experiences together. And as I was reading Merton, I was the originality of it, the connections that he makes between very old ideas, his own soul, and the political climate, the existing culture around him are just so profound.
Yeah.
To him, they're all the same thing. That's what I saw. Yeah. That they're not, it is no different to think about the psychology of the soul, the state of political discourse, and the universal narrative of our faith.
Yeah.
And so, it kind of, can you talk a little bit about that? I know I'm making a statement, but you're the scholar. What is it about his thinking that connects kind of those all of those things? And is that something that you see in his writing as well?
Yeah. So I'll give you a sort of concrete example that I think helps to understand why his grounding in the past helps him to be able to address particular issues in the present. And one is when he talks about the importance of dialogue. And in the Catholic Church, you know, the notion of dialogue really starts to be emphasized after the Second Vatican Council, and we start talking about the importance of dialogue and whatnot. And there are still many people, many Catholics, who are quite wary of what does dialogue mean, and does dialogue mean sort of selling the farm in order to reach some sort of compromise or some sort. And Merton didn't view dialogue in this way. Instead, what's interesting is he goes back to patristic writers, but also medieval writers like Thomas Aquinas. And through the Catholic philosopher Joseph Pieper, he ends up talking about the how it is that the kind of dialogue he is talking about is precisely the kind of dialogue that Thomas Aquinas engaged in. So it was a dialogue that involved the kind of humility that was willing to listen completely and totally to the other person. In Thomas Aquinas' case, it was the ability to listen and to understand the arguments presented by people with whom he didn't agree. Or sometimes it involved appropriating the ideas of people who other people didn't agree with, such as Aristotle, right? And Merton basically said, no, what, you know, this is dialogue is not something new. Dialogue is not something novel or weird. Dialogue is actually at the heart of who we are as Roman Catholics and has been since the very beginning. And so his notion of dialogue, of course, comes into play in his understanding of war and of really of all his understandings of social, when it comes to social issues. And so, like I said, he didn't think he was doing something novel. He thought he was just simply doing precisely what the church has always been doing.
You also mentioned, along with dialogue, how important the idea of silence is in Merton's thinking. Can you talk about the relationship between dialogue and silence?
Well, he understood silence to be the thing that we are constantly trying to avoid. And it's interesting that he writes this. I talk about this with my students a lot because my students wonder, well, what could people be distracted by in the 1960s? I mean, they have phones, they've got Netflix, they've got, you know, all these ways to distract themselves. And yet here in the 1960s, Merton is writing about how we're constantly trying to find ways to distract ourselves and to avoid having to confront the sort of deeper issues about who we are and whatnot. And so if anything, silence is more important today than it was in the 1960s, even more. But his understanding of silence is it involves trying to get below or to go deeper than the constant monologue and conversations that are going on in our minds, and to try and understand that at the very heart of who we are is that we are deeply united with God and also deeply united with one another. And you can only come to that insight, he said, through silence. And once you can come to that insight about who you are and then therefore about who other people are, that's when you can engage in dialogue with them. Because you're not instantly dismissing their arguments. You're not instantly dismissing them as not worthwhile interlocutors, right? You're engaging with them as people who have an inherent beauty, people who have an inherent dignity. And so, like I said, that is simply at the root of a theological understanding of humanity.
Yeah. So what you're describing is silence gives us the ability to pay attention to the fact that the other person on the other side of the conversation with whom we may disagree is still the carrier of the Imago Dei.
Yes.
And that's when true dialogue can begin. And only then.
He has this wonderful account. You probably heard of it. It's a recounting of this moment that he has here in Louisville at the corner of 4th and Walnut. It's right downtown. You can go down there. There's a plaque there. And he talks about seeing all these people around him. And he says, all of a sudden, I realized that I loved these people, that they were mine and I was theirs. And he gets to the point where he says, I came to understand that the immense love that God has for them, this love that means that God even becomes a human being for them, for everybody. And he says, if we could only realize that, if we could only see each other as we really are, he says, there'd be no more war, no more hatred, no more conflict. He says, and this is the quote, the biggest problem is that we would probably fall down and worship each other. I just love that phrase.
I do too. Yes. Lewis says that too in The Weight of Glory. The same. Yeah. If you really saw the glory of what it means to be human,
yeah,
we would be strongly tempted to worship.
Yeah.
That
it does, that reminds me of every time of Alyosha in Dostoevsky.
Yes.
That same moment when he lays down in the crossroads of the street and gathers up the dirt and knows who he is and who the, what the world is.
Yep.
So, okay. So like you said, this white monk who comes out writing about racism in the 1960s, which is a very loud and chaotic age, just as ours is now, right? So what is the link between the contemplative life and social activism? Most people don't see those things as compatible. How did Merton do that?
Well, it really comes out of that vision that he had on the corner of 4th and Walnut, in which he previously, he said, you know, he admits to having this idea that being in a monastery meant that he was separate from the world, or that he was something different than the world and sort of shielded from everything in the world. And it was through that experience, which I think is the kind of, you know, was the fruit of years and years of his own silence and his own pursuit of contemplation. It was realizing that he was in fact actually united with all these people, and that his life was intertwined with theirs. And he may be behind the walls of a cloister or in a monastery, but what he does has an effect on them, just as what they do has an effect on him. And at that point, you know, he has this letter that he, there's a letter we have that he wrote to Dorothy Day in, who was in New York City at the time, in which he says, I just don't think I can only write on prayer and contemplation anymore, right? That there has to be something, a contemplative vision of the world that people are lacking, and that he can provide and sort of provide, help people to look at the world through a different lens. And so, like I said, that his social writings, really, you just can't divorce them from his contemplative vision. And he came to understand that the one necessitates the other.
Huh. Right. So for those of us who see parallels between his age and ours, what action can we take outside of our little bubbles? You know, at Forma, we speak to the intersection between classical thought and contemporary mm-hmm. culture. We're very interested in old ideas, but mm-hmm. the problem with old ideas is that sometimes they can stay old, right? Mm-hmm. We get to a point where we're sitting around in a bit of an echo chamber talking about what Aquinas thought or what Aristotle said or whether I'm a Platonist and these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And Merton had this, that was never enough for him, mm-hmm. right? And as a monk, that could have been. He could have spent, to your point, his whole life in contemplation, beautiful contemplation, wonderful contemplation. But for him, he got to a point that, as you just pointed out in the letter to Dorothy Day, that was not enough for him. He had to take action. Mm-hmm. So for what would you say, or what would he say to people who are in the same place as him in this loud and chaotic age that is never silent and always ideological?
Well, I think the problem is that we have, one of the problems is that we have so many outlets by which we can articulate our opinions and our ideas, and you know, social media, I think, is a wonderful thing, mm-hmm. but it also lends itself to lowest common denominator thinking and argument,
right?
And leads then to deeper polarization. So Merton would look at us right now and see, you know, the incredible polarization at all levels of American society, racially, economically, religiously, politically. And he would say that the role of the person who is interested in the past, the kind of person who's studying the past and who wants to understand more thoroughly what happened then in order to understand what happens now, has then a responsibility to articulate arguments that are not only coherent, but are also open to correction and open to dialogue.
Huh.
And it's that which is sorely lacking right now, right? I mean, you don't go to Twitter or to Facebook to dialogue, right? I mean, it does happen, and I think that it can and should happen, and I think it actually, it's this wonderful tool that actually, if it was used the way it could be, you know, it could actually be a tool for good and to transform us as societies. But right now, it's being, you know, we use it primarily to sort of dunk on our opponents or to sort of, you know, just articulate how wrong somebody else is.
Right.
And so I think with learning has to come, and with study has to come, this kind of humility.
Right.
To recognize that you don't have a full purchase on the truth, but also the humility that says, you know, I can offer something that might provide a different perspective.
Mm, right. Well, and I would just love what you said about his vision for listening and how silence leads to being able to see the other person is more than the representation of an idea I disagree with, but a human being with the image of God who has something to offer to me, even if I'm right. Right.
And even if they're wrong, they have something to offer. Right.
Yes.
And so you always look at somebody with hope rather than condemnation. That's something Merton writes in a really important essay that he wrote called Blessed Are the Meek, the Christian Roots of Nonviolence. And he says that nonviolence is, which is really just another word for dialogue for him, is rooted in the idea that that one has hope in the other person. The hope that says that they're capable of providing something worthwhile to you, but also the hope that recognizes that nobody is beyond redemption.
Okay, what you just said, I want you to riff on that a little bit, that to Merton, nonviolence is another word for dialogue. Mm-hmm. Explain that. That's important.
Well, violence is the ultimate way to shut somebody up. And for Merton, violence was not just about physical violence. It was the kind of violence that he would see, really the kind of polarization of our society, he would see as a sort of enacting of violence against each other, right? Where you look at the other person as if they are beneath you, as if they are subhuman. And he said, you may not actually be physically violent with somebody, but you are violent with them in a way that dismisses their humanity.
Right.
And so for him, you know, in that essay, he doesn't make that direct connection of nonviolence and dialogue, but that's essentially what ends up happening in the essay itself, is that, you know, nonviolence involves having to listen, right? If you're only going, you know, he says there's a form of nonviolence that is actually very violent. You can go and protest in such a way as to make very clear to the other person how wrong they are, right? And he said, if that is what nonviolence is, then that's just as violent as any other thing.
Right.
But if you engage in nonviolence in such a way that the other person understands that you are willing to listen, then the doors for transformation are open in a way that they wouldn't be otherwise.
That's good. I really like that. So another thing Merton is well known for, what I think is very deeply misunderstood, and I'd like you to speak to it, to his connection to Eastern mysticism. Mm-hmm. So can you speak to that and how that's been maybe misunderstood by many Christians?
Yeah, that's what I'm writing about. I'm working on a book right now about, you know, Merton's Catholicism and... you know, you don't have to go very far on the internet to find various websites that call into question, you know, whether Merton can be trusted. Was he really a Catholic? Was he really a Christian? These sorts of things.
Right.
And a lot of that is rooted in the concerns that people have about the study that he was doing of particularly Zen Buddhism, but also of Islam, Judaism, you know, these particularly in mystical or their contemplative traditions. And I think that, again, what he is trying to do is to work again from the understanding of the basic unity of all humankind, that regardless of race or anything like that, or religion or anything, that we are first and foremost already one. In fact, that's a phrase that he uses in Asia on his last trip to Asia, where he says, we are all already one. We just don't know it yet. And Merton is not, you know, people think maybe he was engaging in this kind of study of Eastern religions in a kind of way that negated his own Christianity. But he writes very clearly against that. He said, right, a dialogue that means, you know, syncretism or indifferentism, or what he calls a sort of facile agreement by which we believe everything by believing nothing.
Right, exactly. He said
that's a real problem. But he said what we can understand is, yeah, there are huge theological differences between Zen Buddhism and Roman Catholicism, right? We've got, if we begin our dialogue on the level of theology or doctrine, we're not going to get very far, because it's literally two different theological imaginations at work.
Absolutely.
That don't correlate. But he said, I can't deny that the experiences of these contemplatives, of these mystics, is very similar to the kind of experiences that our tradition has with its own mystics and contemplatives. So we can have a dialogue about the ways in which we share common experiences, and so can learn more from one another and understand one another more thoroughly.
Right.
His engagement with these other religions was about, not about selling his own religion short, or not that he didn't believe in the truths of his own religion. It was about trying to overcome the ways in which we separate each other continually.
Right. Well, to go back to the kind of the meat of our conversation, the idea of sitting in silence and listening and seeing the humanity in the image of God in these other people.
Yeah.
And understanding them and entering their world.
There are these lovely letters that he shares that are not, I've read both sets. The published letters are just the ones that Merton wrote, but I've read the ones of this other person. His name is Abdul Aziz, and he's a Muslim from Pakistan. And he was put in contact with Merton through a Christian theologian, Louis Massignon, who was a Catholic priest, studied Islam, and wrote a great deal about it. And Abdul Aziz writes Merton. The two never met, but he basically says, "Look, I have this. I want to learn more about your own tradition, and I want to tell you a little bit about how I pray and about what is important to me." And it starts this incredible correspondence between the two of them,
wow,
where they are incredibly intimate in their descriptions of their own spiritual lives with each other. Huh. And at one point, Abdul Aziz writes to Merton and says, "Well, how do you pray? You know, can you explain it to me?" And Merton was kind of cagey about responding to those kind of requests, because he thought everybody prayed differently. Uh-huh. And he didn't think that his own way of praying needed to be the way that everybody else prayed.
Right.
But he wrote this letter, and he says this to Abdul Aziz. He says, "You know, I never actually write about this. I want you to know I'm going to tell you about this as a show of the kind of respect and love that I have for you." And he goes and describes how he prays. And it's fascinating that the only record we have of that is a letter to a Muslim in Pakistan.
Letter to a Muslim. That's fascinating and very revealing to his heart, right?
And and he also says to him, you know, I want you to know that I remember you in my mass. And he says, and he doesn't just leave it at that. He says, just so you know what that means, it's that's the most important thing that I do as a Catholic priest. And when I remember you at that time, there's a real significance to that in my own mind. And of course, he believes a significance in terms of his relationship with God. And so, you know, Merton is not, he doesn't shy away from his own identity when he engages in this kind of dialogue.
Right. Right. It's that dialogue and the silence together and understanding people and thus understanding God as their creator.
That's right.
Okay, so we're coming to the end of our time, but I'm so sad about that because this, this is fascinating and convicting, I think. So for our listeners who may not be very familiar with Merton or want to go deeper, where should they start?
Well, I get asked that question a lot, and there are a few places that I suggest. I always love his autobiographical stuff. That said, I don't suggest people start with the Seven Story Mountain
like we did.
he's a little bit heavy-handed in that book.
Yeah, that's true.
In a way that he kind of repudiates later, but he also recognizes it's an important book. There's a really lovely collection of his journal entries, his private journal entries called The Intimate Merton.
Okay.
That I think is a good place to start if you just want to get to know a little bit about who he was. There's also two very good collections of his writings that are worth looking at. One is edited by Lawrence Cunningham, who's at Notre Dame, and it's called Thomas Merton's Spiritual Master, The Essential Writings. And in that book, what you have are a lot of his writings on prayer and contemplation, as well as his writings about Eastern religions, that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then there's a really good, even smaller collection called Thomas Merton Essential Writings.
Okay.
And it's edited by Christine Bochin, and it's published by Orbis Books. And that just has, I think it's one of the best collections out there. And it has really everything. And from there, you'd be able to find the sort of writings that you are most interested in and sort of go from there.
Okay, that's really helpful. And then what about you, Greg? How can our listeners find you and your work that you're doing?
Well, I'm generally, Twitter is the main thing that I'll use. So I'm at Gregory.
You're pretty great on Twitter, by the way. You're funny. So.
Well, yeah, not everybody loves me on Twitter, but yeah.
That's because they haven't internalized the silence and the dialogue lessons yet. So,
So I try to put everything that I'm up to. You know, I'm doing a lecture later this month at the University of Kentucky on Merton and civil rights and that. So I'm at Gregory K. Hillis there.
Okay.
And that's probably the easiest way.
All right. That's fabulous. Thank you so much for being on the Forma podcast and talking to me about this and passing on your knowledge and passion of one of the great thinkers and activists of the 20th century. So thank you so much.
Of course. Thank you.